WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America's tax wars have roots in real wars. President Lincoln imposed the nation's first income tax in the Civil War. Woodrow Wilson taxed the wealthy to pay for World War I, as did FDR for World War II. Now, President Bush is looking to cut taxes for the richest Americans despite looming war. Tonight, On Point, the history of America's tax wars and its lessons for today. But first, the latest on the tense political conflict in Venezuela. One person was killed and dozens wounded during street clashes between Chavez supporters and opposition marchers. The violence comes as Nobel Peace Prize winner Jimmy Carter is in Caracas trying to salvage peace talks between President Chavez and his foes. Phil Gunson, a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor, is in Caracas. I asked him to describe the impact of this violent political conflict.
Venezuela's in the 51st day of a strike which has crippled the oil industry and which, even if it were resolved tomorrow, would take a very long time to recover from the effects of the strike. Normally, Venezuela produces about 3 million barrels of oil a day. And right now, depending on who you believe, it's somewhere between maybe 650,000 and a million barrels a day. But exports are very severely hit and are leaving, if at all, only in a trickle.
Can what's been happening there be described as a counter-revolution? You have Mr. Chavez in power, an elected, albeit radical leader, and you have a reaction to him taking the form of, well, first an attempted coup and now demonstrations. How would you describe what's happening there?
I think it's a clash, a very fundamental clash between two political systems. It's not as if what we had here was a clash between a couple of political parties simply over who should be in government. It's the way in which Venezuelans want to be governed. Now, President Chavez says he's involved in a revolution, and although many people doubt that what he's up to really amounts to that, that's certainly what he believes, and he's changing the rules in a fundamental way. A lot of Venezuelans feel that they never really signed up for that, that they didn't really believe him when he said he was engaged in a revolution, and they feel that they want another chance to tell him whether or not the majority really supports him.
And the revolution is on behalf of the rural poor, is that right?
The revolution is on behalf of the poor, according to what Mr. Chavez says, and it's certainly true that the bulk of his remaining support is concentrated mostly in the poorer sectors of society. And it's worth pointing out that the poor haven't actually done very well under Mr. Chavez. Mm-hmm. We're now 4 years into his government, although he was re-elected in the year 2000, so he's actually, according to his count, on his second term. Mm-hmm. The poor have grown in number since then. Unemployment is well up. Real purchasing power is down, if I remember the figures correctly, over 16%. Thousands of businesses have gone under. Mm-hmm. The economy is in really bad shape. It shrank probably by up to about 10% last year. And even if this situation is resolved quickly, then we're looking at probably another 10% decline in GDP this year.
We read in today's Financial Times that Fidel Castro's Cuba has been far more influential in Caracas than George Bush's mighty U.S. What's going on there?
Chavez is a great admirer of Fidel Castro. He admires him, he says, not because he wants to impose on Venezuela the kind of system that Fidel has imposed on Cuba. He admires him as a great revolutionary hero and so on. I think he also admires him greatly because he's managed to stay in power for 40 years. And Mr. Chavez often says that he'll still be around in 2021, well beyond, incidentally, what the Constitution, which he himself had rewritten in 1999, well beyond what that Constitution actually allows.
According to the Financial Times, one of the reasons the coup against him was successful is that Venezuela has actually been sort of importing thousands of Cuban government employees who are kind of a backbone for Mr. Chavez. Have you seen any of that?
There are a lot of rumors about that. There are rumors about Cubans and Libyans and Algerians and all sorts of people. It's very, very hard to find hard evidence of that. There are certainly Cuban teachers here and Cuban doctors. And in the opposition, people tend to say that they're really Cuban spies in disguise.
Yeah.
There are certainly, I think, in the immediate entourage of Chavez, Cuban security people. And I have fairly strong evidence that there are people working in the intelligence services who have been sent by Fidel Castro. Cuba, of course, has a very efficient and well-trained intelligence service, and it's probably quite natural that an ally of Cuba like Venezuela would take advantage of that kind of expertise.
Now, yesterday we had violence there. Can you describe that and also tell what Jimmy Carter is doing there?
The violence yesterday was fairly typical of what we've been seeing over the past year. There was an anti-government demonstration in an area which the Chavez supporters regard as theirs. They have areas, including the west of Caracas, for example, which they regard as their own territory. And any opposition demonstrations which enter their territory tend to be attacked with stones and bottles and even gunfire. And certainly there was some gunfire yesterday, some of it allegedly coming from the local police force, which is in the hands of pro-government mayor. Mr. Carter has been involved with Venezuela for a few months now, and he originally came down at the invitation of President Chavez, evidently because Mr. Chavez did not want to see the Organization of American States involved in mediating. He felt that Mr. Carter might be more sympathetic, and also that, of course, he had less power to apply sanctions to Venezuela since his organization is a private one. This time, curiously enough, Jimmy Carter came down with a very prominent Venezuelan businessman, Gustavo Cisneros, who is accused by Mr. Chavez of being involved in the coup of April. He went fishing with Mr. Cisneros, and then in the last day or so, he's come back to Caracas, and he's been trying to get the situation moving as far as the talks, which have been chaired for the past 2 months by the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, Cesar Gaviria, but which haven't actually made any progress. So Mr. Carter's come down, I think, to see if he can get those talks moving in some sense, maybe get the government to agree to some form of early election, which pretty much everybody agrees inside and outside Venezuela, except for the government itself, is the way forward.
Because the government would then have to agree to something that's extra-constitutional. The Constitution doesn't call for an election in the immediate offing.
To some extent, the constitutional issue is something of a red herring. Mm-hmm. The real issue is political will. It's not so much an issue of the Constitution. If the government were willing to go into some kind of electoral process or a referendum, then that could happen. It's only because the government has refused to do so that the situation at the moment is stalemated.
Thank you, Phil Gunson, for that clear report.
Thank you very much.
Phil Gunson is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with us earlier from Caracas. We're talking tonight about the link between war and taxes in American history. During World War I, Woodrow Wilson told Congress that Americans were willing to bear any burden and undergo any sacrifice, including taxes. During World War II, the Treasury commissioned Irving Berlin to write a song called "I Paid My Income Tax Today." There was a patriotic spirit about taxes, and the rich were expected to pay the bulk of them. Today, President Bush has already sharply cut taxes on the top 1% and will keep on cutting if his stimulus package becomes law, even as the war on terror continues and war with Iraq looms. Should we stay with historical precedent and raise taxes for those with the biggest stake in the country? Is it their patriotic duty to pay more? Is it yours? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Steve Weisman, chief diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times and author of the new book, The Great Tax Wars, Lincoln to Wilson, The Fierce Battles Over Money and Power That Transformed the Nation. Stephen Weisman, welcome.
Thank you, Jack.
Nice to hear your voice again. And
it's been a long time.
It really has, and I feel like I've been benefiting from your reporting over the years, and now from this rich book, which to any student of American history will suddenly help to make sense of a lot of the background noise to history. So I'm very pleased to have read it, and I recommend it strongly. Steve, give us the sort of a kind of preview of what we're going to be talking about. In general, what has been the connection between war and taxes in our history?
Well, first, Jack, thank you very much for those kind comments. The connection is pivotal. Every time there's been a war in this country, there's been a need for revenue. So the first thing that drives us to tax increases during wartime is simply the cost of war. Remember during the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln and his Treasury Secretary turned to the banks to borrow the money, which is what we do today when we run a deficit. But the banks were so powerful that they said, we're not going to lend you this money until you show us where you're going to get the revenues to pay it back. And that forced the Lincoln administration to turn to taxes. And that led to a debate about who was going to be taxed. And at a time of war, during the Civil War, it made sense to Congress, as reluctant as they were, to raise taxes on the wealthiest Americans.
Who were very few at the time.
They were few, but the Civil War was a transforming event, not just for racial justice in our country, but economically. It was a time when America's industrialization really accelerated because of the spending for the war. And the place that benefited the most from that was New York City, especially, and New York State, and the industrial heartland of the Northeast. They were the ones that made the cloth. That was the area that made the cloth for the uniforms, the cast iron for the weapons. It was during the Civil War that the capital of the dome of the United States Capitol was forged in the Bronx, believe it or not.
In the Bronx.
That meant that families in New York were getting wealthy. Mm-hmm. New York was the center of wealth. But there was no way of taxing that wealth. The only taxes that existed then were tariffs on imports.
And that particular, well, you know, before we get to the tariffs, I just have to note a delicious irony here that it was a Thomas Edwards, a representative from New Hampshire, which to this day is one of the few states that will not allow an income tax.
Right.
Who first helped to propose it. He said, why should we stickle about terms? Why should we not impose the burdens which are to fall upon the people of this country equally in proportion to their ability to bear them? Not only taxing the wealthy, but the notion of graduated taxes.
That's right. You know, throughout our history, we've had a kind of a love-hate. Well, maybe your listeners won't agree that there was a love part of the love-hate of the income tax. Nobody loves the income tax, but I suspect that most Americans, if they had to choose among taxes, think that it's fairest to tax those who have the most wealth in somewhat in proportion to their wealth. But we have another contrary view. I think most of us share this view. It's the supply-side view or the conservative view that taxing wealth is sort of like punishing wealth and punishing the behavior that creates wealth, whether it's hard work or saving or investing or bringing creativity or risk to whatever enterprise you have. You gain wealth from all of those good things, and then it seems unfair to Americans to tax all that wealth and to, in effect, punish all of that good behavior. So we have this kind of conflict that's at the core of our society. What really interested me about this, the reason I wanted to write this mm-hmm. book is knowing that that's the debate that we've had in this country since the Reagan years, where we've been arguing about taxes constantly, I wanted to see what the roots of those arguments were, and I was quite amazed to see that it went back to the beginnings of the 19th century.
Mm. And, of course, you bring it back to Ronald Reagan, and you spoke to David Stockman, his budget director in that administration, and he told you that one of the reasons, perhaps the main reason, Reagan wanted to cut rates on the richest Americans was that after World War II, he was stuck paying 90% marginal rate, and the effect on him was to just discourage his work. He wouldn't make any more movies.
That's right. You're a very acute reader, I have to say. But that's right. David Stockman did tell me that after March or April, when Ronald Reagan had made enough movies to get up to the highest bracket, he thought to himself, why should I make another picture just to have 90% of my earnings go to the federal government?
And he
became a kind of supply-sider back in the 1940s without realizing it.
He found out that taxes can discourage effort, and so cut taxes and you get more effort. We're going to be back, Steve Weissman. Hold on. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the relation between war and taxes in American history. What financial sacrifice did your families have to make in past wars? And what sacrifices are you prepared to make today? Should we stay with the pattern of history and raise taxes for those with the biggest financial stake? Is it their patriotic duty to pay more? Is it yours? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest is Steve Wiseman of the New York Times and the author of The Great Tax Wars, Lincoln to Wilson, The Fierce Battles Over Money and Power That Transformed the Nation. Imran is calling from Ashland, Massachusetts. Welcome, Imran. Good to hear from you again.
Oh, well, thank you. I want to kind of take a point from kind of a legal point, and that is that a lot of times people in the past have tried to sue to not have their taxes go towards a certain area of government, and the courts have always said that a person lacks standing to sue on the basis of taxes, and really it's a matter for the legislature. And so my view is that should you feel patriotic about paying taxes really kind of comes down to whether or not you have an informed democracy that can really understand the issues. And if they are aware of the issues fully, then they have the capacity to entrust, the legislature as well as the executive to make those decisions to go to war. And in the case of Iraq, I just feel like, the media plus the government and everyone collectively, I think along the lines of the media, haven't really been forthright in bringing the issues to the American public. It's just a lot of sloganeering. And so the end result is that you don't have a very informed democracy. And as such, I kind of feel like, you shouldn't have to finance this war because you really weren't participatory in this.
You want out. You don't want your tax money going for this war. I think.
Well, I don't want my money going for this war. And I think, but I would also say that, you know, this whole administration has always been about not really doing what the people want, but more about doing what it wants to do, as evidenced by the policies that come out of the Pentagon and the Defense Policy Board, like Paul Wolfowitz.
Right, right.
Pearl.
Imran, I think we've got it. Steve Wiseman, what about that? The feeling of the injustice of war taxes, especially taxes in time of war, that war resistors have felt.
Well, it's a very interesting point. You know, we tend to think that all our wars were like World War II that had universal support, mm-hmm. but that's not true. Take World War I, for instance. The country was very divided about that war, and Woodrow Wilson himself was drawn into it very reluctantly. And there again, there was a feeling in lots of parts of the country that certain parts of the country were getting wealthy from that war. And when it came time to push through the income tax to pay for the cost of World War I, a great many people in Congress turned to it because they felt it would hit the industrial part of the country hardest, and mm-hmm. that was the place where the pro-war sentiment was the most. So you could make an analogy now, I suspect. If, for instance, you know, a lot of people are going to criticize the possible war in Iraq as a war for oil, I think what will be very interesting to see is if there's a sentiment to hit up the oil companies, let's say, for the profits that they might make out of this war. That's a very traditional approach that people take to financing wars that are themselves very divisive.
That's very interesting that, of course, in the war profiteering tax and of course, in the 30s, when hearings were held about defense spending in World War I, these people were called the manufacturers of death.
Yes. And in fact, there was a war profits and an excess profits tax during World War I. Members of Congress pointed out that companies' profits had gone up 1,000%. Mm. And that echoed really what happened in the Civil War as well.
Mm. Imran, would you settle for that, a sort of compensatory tax on big oil?
Yeah, you know, I think that's an interesting idea. I wonder if it would actually kind of deflate the motivation to go to war with
cheap oil.
Exactly.
Right. Thank you.
Well, it all depends on what happens to oil prices and how profitable this war will turn out to be.
And I'm not taking a position on that because it's very uncertain.
I was thinking drolly today about, you know, things I'd like to tax that are war-related. I mean, if someone started to tax the bloviations of William Bennett, for example, we might be able to defer the national debt. Peter is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm very pleased to be able to get on this and to speak about this question ask some questions. I'd like to make a couple of points, and I'd be very interested in what your guest has to say about them, and you too.
Okay.
The first is that I was concerned to hear him talk about the good qualities that are involved in accumulating wealth, because a lot of what goes on in the United States is passing wealth on from one generation to another.
Mm-hmm.
And President Bush apparently wants to do away with that, and to a very large degree. And I don't know that there's any good qualities at all involved in inheriting wealth. In fact, the recent University of Michigan stuff about
affirmative action?
Yeah, affirmative action has raised the question about the legacy factor, namely, so that's one question. What about, why don't we just abolish the possibility of inheriting, say, more than $1 million per family?
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing is I'd like to talk about the working poor.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a private school teacher, and I come very close to being one of those.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that I think the federal income tax doesn't tax the first 6,000.
Mm-hmm.
I think that should be the first 30,000.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be a meaningful tax reform that would save a lot of money in the IRS.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, the president actually does want to increase the minimum on the taxes. He does want to raise it, I think, from, in other words, the amount of money you don't have to pay. If you earn X, you don't have to pay taxes on it. Isn't that right, Steve, that isn't that part of the sort of the progressive part of this stimulus package?
Yes, it is. And although most of the attention is focused on the tax cut on dividends,
mm-hmm.
And the top rates, you're right. The president does propose to increase or lower taxes and expand the bracket that doesn't pay income taxes. And before he's done, he might be forced, as Bill Clinton and the first George Bush did, to expand what the refundable part of the tax, which we call the earned income tax credit, where they actually send a check to the lower income taxpayers as a compensation for the Social Security taxes that they pay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there will, I'm sure, be a part of that.
Mm-hmm,
and, for a second, if I may, to address the interesting question about the estate tax.
Yes.
The estate tax, too, is one that we've been arguing about since at least the Civil War. There was an estate tax as part of the Civil War, and then again in the Spanish-American War, and then it finally became permanent after the turn of the century, along with the income tax. And it is striking to me that the Congress has now repealed it, as you know, although it is repealed in stages and there's a talk about reconsidering that. But I think there again, reflects the essential conflict that we have in our society
mm-hmm.
about wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And but certainly there's been the argument that our caller has made all through history, including going back to Andrew Carnegie, who was one of the earliest advocates of the estate tax, not simply because of its fairness, but also he felt that leaving large sums in estates to his own heirs was debilitating to them and sapped their moral fiber and strength.
Mm. Peter, I don't know whether you're aware of it, but in Wisconsin, probably, just as I'm extrapolating from New York, because in the state of New York, I think I have this right, under the current law, which I think will allow exemptions, you don't have to pay taxes on estate. I think it's going to go up to $2 million. Bush wants to abolish it completely so there'd be no limit. But I think under current law, only about 150 people a year earn enough, die with enough estates that big to pay that tax. Bush wants to cut those taxes for those 150 people. So if the 150 people in Vermont, I mean in New York, there can't be 50 in the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah. I guess what I was talking about was something different. Rather than having any idea of an estate tax per se, how about an estate limit of $1 million? And that's it.
Oh, I see. It's essentially to have a kind of a confiscatory thing.
A cap on how much you can pass on to the next generation.
And that would sort of be, I could see a character argument for that, Steve Weisman. I mean, that was part of the argument that used to hear that people should start on their own feet.
And you often hear people saying that about the estates that they plan to leave themselves. And one of the biggest advocates of the estate tax now, as you probably know, is Bill Gates' father, William H. Gates, mm-hmm. who's been campaigning for it. But I think it's unlikely, don't you? I mean, because I think most Americans, as someone put it, favor their aspirations rather than their realities. And most think that they can accumulate the money and then leave it to their kids, and they would rather do that.
And yet here's the statistics, 24 people in the state of Maine, 150 people in the state of New York, and yet apparently ordinary Americans think they're going to be one of the 24 people.
Well, I know that my belief is that there's a lot of ignorance about the estate tax. People don't exactly know, for instance, how narrowly focused it is on only the very wealthiest. And if they understood that, I think they might rethink their opposition to the estate tax. I know there's a poll actually being undertaken by NPR on attitudes on taxes. But a lot of it depends on how the question is asked. I think you know that, Jack.
Indeed. And in fact, the inheritance tax, well, there was a lexical triumph, and it was called the death tax. And of course, who wants to tax? My God, they're even taxing death. Rick is calling from Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Welcome.
Hi. I just want to say I think the best rationale for a progressive tax is the fact that people who accumulate wealth are using the resources of the government a lot more than somebody who's just doing a 9-to-5 job. In other words, if I have 20 people in my company and all of them were helped raised by the government, all of them were helped educated by the government, some of them probably had scholarships, they're making me money. When mm-hmm. they come to work in the morning, they're using the roads to get mm-hmm. to work. They're making themselves money also, but they're making me money. Mm-hmm. Every mm-hmm. time, even mm-hmm. to the point where the government's, who are they protecting more? Protecting me and my truck, or are they protecting Enron?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All the way down to, all the money that the government invests to keep the infrastructure going, to keep research going, to keep, business trips afloat. And that's why the excise tax should be, you're married to the government. The government's your partner your whole life. If you've accumulated wealth, it's like your wife. Give half to the government and then go on. That's what I think.
Thank you, Rick. Maybe you want to hold on. Steve, what about that? This debate has been heard again and again about the justice of graduated rates and the idea that the wealthier you are, the more you are benefiting from everything the country is and does.
Well, you're right, Jack. That argument has been made throughout history. And while we were, while I was listening, I was trying to find the quote from William Jennings Bryan, but I can't find it. But he makes exactly that point on the floor of Congress, saying that who is it that benefits from the government, especially at time of war, but any time? Does the government mobilize its army to protect the poor farmer or worker in the city, or does it protect the great fortunes that are guarded at our seaports and the great citadels of our wealth? Mm-hmm. When you read Bryan, of course, Bryan is known for his great rhetoric, the Cross of Gold, and other campaigns, and maybe he's known as a kind of comical figure for attacking evolution much later in his life. But in the 1890s, he was the principal advocate of the income tax in Congress. And his speeches are on fire with eloquence and outrage. And he makes exactly the point that this gentleman is making.
Mm. And it was the income tax versus what was, in effect, a national sales tax that was a regressive tax. That sales tax was paid by everybody who purchased an American item because tariffs kept the price of foreign imports so high.
That's right. In fact, if you bought anything for your household, whether it was starch or some machinery for your farm, you paid as much as 40 to 50% above what you normally would have paid if there were no tariffs. Because, of course, although the tariff was only on the import, the fact that the tariff existed allowed domestic manufacturers to raise the price of their goods to the level of the imported goods. And so it was like a 40 or 50% sales tax, and it went into the coffers of the great industrial cartels, the trusts that were the great enemy of the populace and the progressives around the turn of the century.
And, of course, the trusts had a grip on politics, perhaps comparable only to today's corporations on politics. That was the era, after all, when Henry Demarest Lloyd could say of the Pennsylvania legislature that Standard Oil did everything to it except refine it.
That's right. And, of course, after the turn of the century, we got the first campaign finance reform under Teddy Roosevelt, where he barred corporations from giving contributions to political candidates.
Rick, thank you for your call. We want to just briefly bring us, you mentioned that Bryan had to raise the issue of the income tax again in the 1890s, that we've just seen it instituted for the Civil War. What happened after the war? Was it abolished? Did it just go away?
The income tax was abolished or rescinded in stages after the Civil War, in large part because of the surpluses that were piling up as the economy took off. Then it was reenacted in the 1890s at the height of what was the greatest economic downturn America had experienced until then, and indeed until the Great Depression of the 1930s. But a year after it was enacted, it was declared unconstitutional in a decision in 1895 that was one of the most controversial decisions in the history of the court. The court was reviled by Bryan and others for being political, and it took a ratification step to reenact the tax after the turn of the century.
We'll be back. I beg your pardon. We'll be back to talk about that more. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
From Boston University.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about the relations between war and taxes in American history. We're asking, what financial sacrifices did your family make in past wars, and what sacrifices are you prepared to make today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest is Steve Weisman. He's the chief diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times and author of the new book, The Great Tax Wars, Lincoln to Wilson, The Fierce Battles Over Money and Power That Transformed the Nation. Steve, you had just taken us up to the effort to constitutionalize the income tax. Take us there and tell us about that, and then bring us to what you call an act that was historic in almost every way. That is to say, Woodrow Wilson's War Revenue Act of October 1917.
The constitutional amendment was launched in 1909 by, of all people, William Howard Taft, not someone you think of as a great pioneer in progressive taxation. Mm-hmm. He put it through as an amendment to a tariff bill, and almost nobody thought that it would ever get ratified because it required three-quarters of the state legislatures. What really turned the tide for the tax was the upheaval in 1910 and 1912 when the Republican Party split apart into a progressive and old guard branches symbolized by Taft or by Teddy Roosevelt on the progressive side and Taft on the old guard side. And that split led to the Democrats returning to power in enough state legislatures to put the tax amendment over the top. And it was ratified in 1913, just as Woodrow Wilson came into office, and then enacted as a law in his first year. And a year later, as Cordell Hull said, Cordell Hull was then a congressman. He later was Secretary of State under Franklin Roosevelt. But a year after it was enacted, the shots rang out in Sarajevo. World War I began. There was a tremendous need for revenue, and Woodrow Wilson pushed through Congress an incredibly progressive and almost punitive tax bill that not only imposed the income tax, the estate tax, but it taxed war profits and what were called excess profits. And this was really repugnant to the capitalists of the time, who thought that the whole concept of excess profits was disgusting. And indeed, by 1918, the Northeast turned against Woodrow Wilson and helped to put in a Republican Congress, in part because of their unhappiness over the income tax. And Republican Congress, by the way, then is what rejected the Versailles Treaty. So you could almost say that the income tax was pivotal and the controversy over it was pivotal in having the Congress reject the Treaty of Versailles and the League of Nations and break the heart and break the spirit of Woodrow Wilson.
Yes, and of course he said broke the heart of the world.
Yes.
Jeff is calling from Boston, Mass. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you. I just want to make the point, it seems like, excuse me, implicit in your argument is that the wealthy aren't paying their fair share. But, you know, some of the data that I see suggests that the top 5% of income earners pay more than 50% of all the income taxes, and the top 50% pay effectively all the income taxes. And in fact, that skew has increased over the last 14 years. So, you know, these individuals are paying almost all of the taxes as it stands now.
You know, you're absolutely right that the richest pay under our graduated system pay the most in taxes. The president has made this point again and again. And that's one of the reasons he says it's only fair that if you cut taxes, their taxes should be cut as well. What about this picture of the issue of justice of the injustice of demanding more of the very rich who are already paying so much in wartime?
Well, look, it's impossible to talk about taxes or enact taxes without arguing about this, what's fair and who should pay the most. But the fact is, although the caller has identified a very real problem, the numbers vary, different people have different arguments, but you're quite right that the very rich pay most of the income taxes. The only problem is that we have a broad array of taxes in our society. We have sales taxes, we have excise taxes, and of course we have Social Security taxes, which are by any definition regressive taxes. They are paid right off the first dollar, no matter what your income is. So I think the question can be raised, if you're going to cut taxes, why pick the one that only the rich pay to cut? Why not cut some of these other taxes that are shared by everyone? And that's a fair argument. There's arguments on all sides. The one thing that bothers me is when people say, well, the poor or the middle class don't pay any taxes because they don't pay that much in income taxes. And that's simply not true. They pay sales taxes and, as I say, Social Security and Medicare taxes.
Yes, and the picture, you know, as I think about the, of course, the other answer to this is the rich earn the money. And you get a kind of, but I can understand the sheer terror of writing out a huge check to the government. This fellow that won the lottery in West Virginia got $300 million, and what did he have to do? He immediately had to give $150 million of it back. Yeah. I tell you what, if I had to make out a check for, he didn't have to, but if you had to make out a check for $150 million, I don't care what you earned. You'd think this is not fair.
That's right. We really, but as I was saying before, maybe some of us might think it's fair for lottery winners, but most of us feel, we, especially coming through the 90s, a lot of Americans feel that, the incentive to get wealthy is what makes this country grow. It's the nature of our system. Why kill off the incentives that make that create a system that gives wealth to everybody? That is the fundamental tension in our society.
And the issue, of course, is where you draw the line. How much incentive does someone need? Does a man need to live in 10 people's houses and eat 20 people's dinners and drive in 50 people's cars? Or can he be happy in 2 people's houses and eating 4 people's dinners and 3 people's cars?
That's right. And, of course, it was Abraham Lincoln, though, who, when he was a state legislator, said, look, let's have a progressive property tax. He said, after all, the wealthy are very few and the rest of the voters outnumber them. So this is very practical. And if you need the money, you go where the money is.
The old Willie Sutton idea. Steve
right.
Weisman, thank you so much for joining us.
Jack, thanks for having me.
It's been a great pleasure, and you've written a really interesting book that, as I say, fills in many of the gaps that most of us didn't learn in school and can learn in a very entertaining way in Steve's book. Thank you. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a culinary tour of the rations being served to American troops overseas. This is On Point. American troops heading overseas now enjoy more creature comforts than ever soldiers did before. No more nameless stews, porridges, sea rations. Today, it's lasagna, bean and rice burritos, and shrimp Creole, all thanks to the Combat Feeding Program in Natick, Massachusetts, which engineers the meals for the armed services. Today's rations are efficient to eat, nutritious, affordable, and tasty. We took a tour of the Natick facility to find out about the technology of the full stomach. Our guide was Gerald Darsh, the director of the Combat Feeding Program.
This is basically what we call a pilot plant, and what you'll find in a facility like this are smaller scale versions of equipment that you would find in the commercial sector, in large scale food industry. We have a lot of requirements that our combat rations, for example, have to meet. We have to have a system that will have a shelf life of a minimum of 3 years at 80 degrees Fahrenheit and 6 months at 100. We have to be able to toss it out of aircraft at 2,000 feet and above with a parachute, throw it out of a chopper at 100 feet without a parachute. We have to be able to store, distribute, and serve our combat rations at temperature extremes as low as minus 60 degrees Fahrenheit up to 120 degrees Fahrenheit. And after we just really put it through the logistical wringer, those items still have to look good, they still have to taste good, and they still have to be traditional and familiar and palatable to the warfighter. In terms of what's available on the battlefield today, it's almost as though you're looking at a menu from a four-star restaurant. We have Jamaican pork chop with noodles. We have seafood jambalaya. We have country captain chicken. We have things like Yankee pot roast. We have a whole host of products to include vegetarian meals that are now available in the MRE repertoire. We always try to honor our requests from our warfighters when we go to the field because their input is the key element in designing new rations and improving current rations. As you can imagine, when you bring 1.2 million people to breakfast, lunch, and dinner, it's going to be pretty tough to please everybody all the time. So consensus has to drive the train in terms of what goes in and what comes out. Some of the more unique requests that we've had from warfighters, for example, can you give me a baked twin lobster, liver pate? However, the warfighter who asked me that question, standing directly behind him, was another warfighter who said, Mr. Daesh, if you ever put liver pate in the MRE, you can run, but you can't hide. We've got probably somewhere in the vicinity of 50 different projects that we're running for the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, and the Air Force. As you can see on this table, this happens to be an item that our warfighters have requested. In addition to conventional pocket sandwiches, they were looking at things like breakfast pocket sandwiches. We've already developed a cheddar cheese and bacon pocket sandwich, and this one happens to be a maple honey French toast pocket sandwich. Now, in the case of a pocket sandwich, we're looking at what we call hurdle technologies. For us to take a pocket sandwich and put it in a flexible pouch, we had to apply technology to make a product like this to retain its integrity so it looks, tastes, smells, and chews like a pocket sandwich 3 years down the road, yet remains commercially sterile. And if you can picture a track and field event, the more hurdles you put and the higher they are, clearly the more difficult it is for that runner to get over them all and finish the race. Our goal is that bacteria will never finish the race, and we want them to die trying. The one thing that is kind of interesting to a lot of people, many of the products that you'll find in the commercial marketplace, as you walk up and down the grocery store aisles, about 30% of what you find in the grocery store is either a direct or indirect spinoff of technology pioneered for the military, freeze-dehydrated coffees and freeze-dehydrated meals. If you're a hiker and a backpacker, you will likely be taking some of these products with you as you scale Mount whatever. M&M's, developed for the military, for the Pacific Theater, early in World War II. The requirement, of course, was that the warfighter wanted to have some sort of a chocolate that would melt in his mouth, not in the sand, I guess. And M&M Mars came up with a way of pan-coating that chocolate, and then they actually came in a tube. So M&M's originally were stacked one on top of each other. We look at cryovac beef, for example. A lot of that was pioneered here. Restructured meat, where you could take less costly cuts of meat and then restructure them to look like a chicken piece or a beef steak or whatever it is. One thing, however, that we are given credit for that I must reluctantly admit we didn't have anything to do is Tang. We're walking up into now is a rather unique piece of equipment, and its purpose is to actually produce foods for Air Force high reconnaissance pilots. And we refer to them affectionately as tube foods. It looks exactly like a tube of toothpaste. It has a cap and a thread on the top. The tube foods will range anywhere from entrees, sloppy joes. We have clam chowder, beef and gravy. We also have an apple pie. It was tough to get the crust in the tube, but we were able to do that. Once the pilot is going to use these products, he or she will then put the food transfer unit threaded on the top. There's a perforation device in there, and then it's slid through their pressurized helmet through a portal, and they're able to dine. So the bottom line is that everything that goes in or comes out of a current combat ration system is warfighter recommended, warfighter selected, warfighter tested, and warfighter approved. So clearly, it is the warfighter, our customers, who are driving how we improve the current combat feeding systems.
Gerald Darsh, our tour guide, is the director of the Combat Feeding Program in Natick, Massachusetts. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. This is